Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me? Okay, this is Jenna Mitchell with DPS. And before we get started, I just need to identify. We have an external that's anonymous. Is that a member of the public or a board member?
This is Dr. Miller. I had to call in.
And unmute as our member of the public.
As anonymous.
I do think we have some members of the public.
We have two members of public.
Okay, so I think that's the anonymous.
No.
Are you guys able to hear me? This is Dr. Miller. I had to call in and it's showing as anonymous. It wouldn't let me write my name.
All right. Madam Chairwoman, if you would like to start the meeting, we can do a roll call and just make sure that we have enough board members present.
Yes. Okay, yeah, thank you. So it's 1:40 p.m. Thank everyone for your flexibility and patience. I'm going to go ahead and call the meeting to order. Let's get started. Major Mitchell, will you start with roll call, please?
Yes, ma'am. So we'll start. Dr. Blades is present. Ms. Atkins?
Present.
And we can't hear you, so just want to make sure you can unmute.
Yeah, present, yes.
We are not able to hear you.
We're still not hearing you. I think we might have some problems. Can anyone else hear her?
Yes.
They're shaking yes, and they can hear us, but we can't hear them.
I'm present.
Is the speaker plugged in?
If they could hear Dr. Miller, is it just me they can't hear, or is it everybody they can't hear? Scott, you want to try, or Missy?
I can hear you, Amanda. And I could hear Dr. Miller as well.
I know sometimes my computer switches over to an audio that stops me from hearing everyone, so I'm wondering if that's happening on their end.
Well, for what it's worth, Missy, I can hear you as well. So,
yeah, I can hear everyone, although, what's her name? The woman that runs the meeting,
Jenna,
that was talking, her voice was really low. I had to turn my audio clear up.
Yeah, I mean, I can see several people's icons there, but I don't see people and their mics are turned off. There's several people that appear to be present, but their mics are turned off.
Yeah, so I see Sheridan Garrett Ashleisha. Oh, that's a pretty name. And Anthony.
Missy, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to turn yours off then? Yeah.
I'm not sure who was talking.
Okay, this is Jenna Mitchell with DPS. We're going to start roll call again. Dr. Blades is present. Ms. Atkins?
Present.
Thank you. Mr. Hanratty?
Present.
Dr. Miller?
Present.
Mr. Mori? Ms. Music?
Present.
And Mr. Negley?
Present.
And excused are Mr. Barney and Dr. Gray. So, Madam Chair, you have a quorum. We have seven members present.
Madam Chair,
matters for discussion. First agenda item is old business. Rachel, would you want to do that first one, or are you going to ask about the date change?
Yes. So I sent out information to all the board members. It was brought to our attention that the originally scheduled meeting on November 11th falls on a state holiday, Veterans Day. So we have rescheduled that meeting to November 4th, and that's been updated on the website. And I think I sent out a new list of meeting dates for 2026 for all of the subcommittee members.
Hey, Jenna, just so you can hear me, I can hear you very clearly, and I think others can as well, but I don't think we can hear Brecken.
Okay, we will see what we can do to change that. Give us just a minute. Can you hear me?
Yes, with feedback.
Okay, so we're testing. This is Jenna Mitchell at DPS. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, and Dr. Blake is going to speak, so we'll see. Well. You got it muted and turned off. Okay. All right. So you have to mute it and turn your speaker off. Otherwise we're going to get that feedback. Okay.
All right,
so we will have Dr. Blake test one more time to see if you guys can hear.
Okay, can anyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, still a little bit of feedback, though.
Yes.
The feedback was for Jenna this time instead of Dr. Blades, or Ms. Blades.
That looks like that's taking care of it. Okay.
I'm also logged into Teams.
So do you want to turn your mic on? Speak from it.
Let me see. I'm not muted, but my volume is all the way down, which should take care of the feedback, I think. So they should be able to hear me.
Yes.
Because I think this will probably pick up this also. Okay. I think we did roll call. Okay, can anyone hear me now better? This is Brecken.
Yes.
Yeah, you can. Okay. I have no pictures, but that's good. Okay. Okay. The next item on the agenda is the continued discussion on standards and research from other states and entities. I just wanted to close up any discussion that we had from our last meeting. I know we had presentations from a few states. I think I briefly touched on Colorado, although we didn't go through it in depth. I wanted to ask, one, were there any other jurisdictions or agencies or anywhere else that we needed to discuss? I can share a little bit about Colorado, but I was hoping to shift the discussion into kind of some of the next agenda items, which are what's going on in Arizona currently, and then how can we start to take some of the knowledge that we've gathered from other places and start to implement recommendations for our own state. But I wanted to first, like I said, kind of close out or continue any discussion on the standards, if anyone has anything. Seems like no.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. It's not
It's not showing the visuals, huh?
I don't have pictures on mine. I just have people's initials, so I'll have to kind of. So if you could help me, if someone has their hand up, that would be great. Okay. Okay. Go ahead, please, Scott. Yes.
Yeah. I took time as I indicated I would to reach out to a colleague.
Do you want to turn my speaker on?
Are we good?
He's still talking.
No, I stopped because you started talking. I wasn't sure what to
do. I wasn't sure if you had paused or if I wasn't picking it up.
No.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
We have you now. Yes.
Okay. So I reached out to a colleague, Dr. James Werling in Canada, to try to get some structural information about their system and about assessment and treatment, both as it relates to adults and juveniles. So if it's okay, I just want to read the paragraph that he sent to me regarding the adult system. Is that okay if I do that?
Yes.
Okay, so here it is. Our adult system starts at age 18, and if you are actually charged, convicted, and sentenced to 2 years or more, the process is handled by our federal, i.e. national government. If you receive an adult sentence that is anything less than 2 years, then each province in Canada manages that process. We don't have anything like you folks have in several United States, such as sex offender management boards or sex offense-specific standards. As such, I have never seen any document outlining specifically who can or cannot conduct assessments or deliver interventions. As you can imagine, there's a lot of variability and how people are assessed and treated.
Okay.
That was helpful to me. It was helpful to me because I always wondered who in their system ended up in the federal system and who ended up in the provincial system. And I didn't have any clue how those two systems interfaced or how decisions were made. That really cleared things up that way for me.
Yes, Jim.
Jim Hanratty. Just a question about that statement you made. When you say sentence, does that include community supervision or sentencing like to corrections?
Yeah, I don't want to stand on this statement, Jim, but I think it's possible that everybody who gets sentenced in Canada is sentenced to some period of incarceration. So I think that when Jim uses this term sentenced, I think he's meaning that literally, though I will go back and I will check that out again with him. But I think it also explains, if I'm accurate with regard to that, it also explains why things like, you know, the age item and some other variables on some of the actuarial risk assessments in terms of the operational definitions begin to make more sense to me, where we over here on this side of the border have to be really careful to make sure that we read the manuals and such to make sure that we're interpreting things in a manner that's consistent with the definitions of these items. But a long-winded answer is I think sentenced means to incarceration.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for reaching out and getting that information. That was helpful and interesting. I can kind of do a quick summary of what I found from the Colorado guidelines. Essentially, they say that each sex offender shall be the subject of a pre-sentence investigation, or a PSI, which shall include a sex offense specific evaluation. This report should be prepared in all cases where it has been ordered by the court. So it sounds like, to me, that happens pretty early. The pre-sentence investigation is just, as it sounds, pre-sentence. So, but in keeping with some of the other states, I believe it was Idaho and was it Utah, that also have sex offense specific evaluations early on in the process, if I'm remembering the patterns correctly.
That's correct. Idaho has mandatory for adults, and it's discretionary, not really discretionary, but it's a case by case basis for juvenile.
Yeah. Okay.
Doing evaluations.
Yes. Or sentencing and evaluation at the same time.
Okay.
So the courts facilitate that and make sure that's done.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Utah is the one that they had just the range, right? And then the evaluation. Yeah. Okay. Well, okay. So let me ask this. Does anyone have any additional items in terms of the review of the states we've done? Any further discussion on standards and research from other states and the entities as we've heard it thus far? No? Okay. Okay. So the next. Oh, go ahead.
Quick. Will the research and things that folks conducted, the executive briefs, will that be available if folks want to go back or take a look at that?
I believe all of them were sent to Major Mitchell or to the board.
Phenomenal.
Major Mitchell, yes, they're posted. Those that we have received are posted on the DPS website on background material.
Scott Nagley here. I haven't sent anything in because I wanted to make sure I had a chance to report it here at this meeting before I did that. So I will make sure to send the paragraph in that I just wrote, just read.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So then moving to the next agenda item would be discussion of Arizona's initial evaluation practices for adults. And I wanted to just pause here. I think more than likely everyone is at least has a cursory familiarity with what is going on. But since also we have Chairwoman Golden with us, we can get your perspective on it a little bit from a probation standpoint if you want to chime in. But essentially, the way that I see it as a treatment provider is that our pre-sentence investigation does not include a sex offense evaluation of any kind. We don't really do that for everyone. What happens is someone gets on probation, sentenced to probation, and then once they're on probation, they receive a referral to one of the agencies that's contracted. So I guess this is also just Maricopa County that I'm speaking for. I couldn't speak to many of the outlying counties, but essentially, instead of a full evaluation, the individual, once they're placed on probation, the adult, goes through a series of sort of intake interviews and testing with the treatment agency combined with some of the risk assessments that are done by probation. And then they're placed into a group and recommendations are made from there regarding treatment and probation. Does anyone else understand it differently than that?
Scott Nagley here. Brecken, I don't know if this is different, except for to say that, and I don't know the percentage because I'm only me, others might be able to comment as well, but obviously a fair number of pre-sentence risk assessments are being done either through the public defender's office making referrals to people to do those, or private attorneys being hired by defendants and then private attorneys making contact with persons such as myself and others to do pre-sentence risk assessments. So I think there's two levels of this going on, and obviously not for everybody who's being charged with something.
Mm-hmm. Right, you're right. And so, yeah, thank you for bringing that up. So there are a fair amount of pre-sentence risk assessments being done, but those are not typically ordered by anyone in the sense of the court system, is my understanding. Those are undertaken kind of privately, so to speak, at the request of an attorney. So
that I think that's absolutely a true statement as it relates to Maricopa County, but I think in some outlying counties, because of the smaller scale of the process, that there are times where the judge is actually ordering people to do that with consultation and consent of both the county attorney in those cases and the client's defense attorney. So I think there are some outlying counties for sure that it is directed by the court.
Okay.
I have a question.
Yes, Jim.
Jim Hanratty. That's pre-conviction, and usually for mitigation, if it's oriented by the defendant and it's his rep or her representation. So that would be something that may or may not be necessarily accepted by probation, correct me if I'm wrong, as a gold standard of how they're going to be assessed. Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong on that.
No, you're not wrong. I would say that's one of the issues with it, is that there are varying degrees of probation's acceptance and treatment agency's sort of acceptance, so to speak, of the validity of the testing and whether that will substitute for the testing that's typically ordered by probation. The other piece, I think, in terms of that timeline, that's a complication, is that if it's pre-sentence or pre-conviction, even say, and someone is then, sentenced to 10 years, 20 years in prison, and then they come out, how relevant is that, the risk assessment that was done pre-sentence, you know, and then what do we do in that instance? But I think it's good information to know that. So some, what you're saying, Scott, is that some counties outside of Maricopa are having the evaluations ordered by the court, but in Maricopa, largely they're privately done.
Yep. In post-sentence is what you're saying.
Well, and it's not even in terms of, yes, the pre-sentence, but what's done by probation in Maricopa County or what's sort of sanctioned by them is not a full evaluation for every person. It's really just the ABLE and the MSI.
Yeah.
Done, right. You know, to get kind of a snapshot. And then, like I said, some intake interviews and probation has assessments and then people kind of go on their way through the process. So I think part of why I wanted to pause here and talk about what's being done in Arizona is because I think our next sort of task here is to take this information and talk about, you know, kind of now what do we do with it, and what we can have that discussion today in terms of what are some suggestions, or how do we merge what we know from other states plus what we have going on and start to recommend how to go forward. I think the other option would be to do work groups or kind of divide that up and come back. That's what I see as our next kind of task. But I'm open to feedback or if you have thoughts on it, Beth, about where you see this going next.
Yes, Beth Golden, I'll add, I think, you know, there's no rhyme or reason to kind of what we do in the state, right? Which is why we're here. What often concerns me is the amount of money people on probation spend on doing assessments and reassessments because, you know, say they do something pre-sentence, but then the state doesn't accept it or the defense attorney doesn't want to give it up because it doesn't look favorably, but it was, say, $4,500. And then they go to probation and there's a lot of thousands and thousands of dollars, I feel like, that gets spent. And then probation says, well, you might have one probation officer say, nope, we're not going to even take that, when really it should be turned over to the provider to analyze that information. So I think it's very costly when not done right, if you will. And I guess the conversation to me, when I look at other states, information is not necessarily held against clients for taking these assessments, where I think in Arizona, the concept is that I'm going to be punished for honesty, which, as we all know, we want honesty. And the faster we can be honest, or, you know, have an offender be honest, the quicker, hopefully, they can receive treatment and So how, and I don't know if this is a question for today, but there needs to be this shift, I think, in Arizona of we need good quality assessments as soon as possible to then determine what treatment and supervision is effective for this individual, are kind of my initial thoughts on what I see. And I just, as you all know, sometimes someone takes an ABLE like six times or like, why, you know, why, and the amount of, so those are some of my initial thoughts on that.
No, I think it does. I think our system, when I was thinking about this and going through our system, at least in Maricopa County, because of the way it's kind of, it's not uniform in what you were speaking to, is it puts us in a position of being reactive instead of proactive about this. So instead of proactively understanding someone's risk and needs, we are just reactive as the information comes in, which often creates confusion. Perhaps they're spending additional time and money doing something. Maybe we retest them. It doesn't, this will be more making a recommendation about implementing some kind of evaluation sort of protocol early on will be more work and comes with a lot of logistical challenges up front, but it potentially saves a lot of confusion and effort and money in the process overall.
Yes, Beth Golden, even when someone may want to apply for a modification or early termination, often attorneys are like, redo a full psychosexual evaluation, which when someone's been on probation for 15, 20, 30 or more years, there should be, and I'm not saying every county, because I think every county has limited resources, especially regarding treatment, right? Mm-hmm. But how do we get those counties the resources that that they need to do proper assessments? But we should just, I think we're over assessing, if you will, if we have the right formula or standards in place, we should, I hope that would be the goal to kind of get it right, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, I agree. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think a piece of this that's emerging from this discussion today is perhaps a need for defining what are the components of a psychosexual evaluation, and what are the pieces of that there's consensus on that are musts as part of those evaluations. And then the secondary piece of that is trying to get some clarity and perhaps define with clear purpose, you know, who are the people that can do these kinds of evaluations, and what kinds of training and education and professional competencies have they developed to meet a set of standards so that they can be approved to do this kind of evaluation. So I think for me it seems to me that, you know, piece of it is defining what is a psychosexual evaluation and what must that include, and the second step is who can do it, and what do they need to bring to the table in order to be deemed appropriate for doing it? That's just me as I listen to the emerging discussion, both from you, Brecken, and from you, Beth.
Jim Panderetti. Also, shouldn't we have guidelines as to whether or not the courts are going to mandate it or not?
Right.
In the first place. Mm-hmm. So where's the authority to do it? Is it going to be optional? Is it going to be up to the offender and his resources? And if they can't afford it, then what? Is it only for the rich offenders, so to speak?
Well, I think that's the problem with what starts to happen now, is that because in Maricopa County they're done privately, there's not a lot of, I guess, unless you're indigent, there's different, you know, funding options. But otherwise, a lot of times it is largely up to someone who's able to afford it. And so I think in some ways this would be an effort to minimize the disparities in that, you know, and make those type of resources and that type of assessment available more broadly.
So can we agree at some point we're going to make a decision as to if it's being mandated or not?
Well, I think to roll it backwards even further, because I agree with you, Scott, I think those are some of the questions that will come up. I think the first question, based on the research that we all looked at, is do we as a committee recommend that Arizona should implement some kind of evaluation early on in the process? I mean, that's the first thing, is that's what a lot of the other states were doing. Do we think that would be helpful here? That's step one. And if we're all in agreement, then we can go from there. But, you know, let's hear from
and I think I don't mean to be getting stuck in the tall grass here, but what is early on in the process? Do you know what I mean? I mean, I think some of these other states are in fact doing an evaluative process, which they've defined for themselves in the pre-sentence phase of the process. So I think we have to make a decision about when we use the term early on, what are we talking about?
Yeah, I agree with you. And in my mind, that's question two. So the first one is, are we in agreement about a recommendation about an evaluation? That's why I was diffuse about it, you know? And so I guess the first step is, do we think that would be a useful addition or change to the Arizona sort of process right now? And then if we do think that an evaluation, a risk assessment as kind of a standard operating procedure would be helpful, when, the next question I think is, when is that given? Is that part of the pre-sentence process, or is it sort of in place of the ABLE MSI intake, you know, kind of a portion of someone's probation that's being done now? They're two really different. You know, fewer people are going to get it on probation because not everyone who's sentenced gets probation. So it's a little bit about what is the purpose of the evaluation, right? At the probation level, that would be about informing treatment and supervision needs. At the pre-sentence level, that could potentially be more about informing the person's sentencing at that point. And then we would have to look at, would it need to be redone? Say they're released many, many years later, then what do we do for those people? But first, does anyone have thoughts on whether, do we even like this idea of an evaluation being included?
Peter Moore, yes.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
Okay. Amanda, yes.
Beth Golden, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Amanda Atkins, yes. I think there should be like a standard assessment, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and nothing I'm saying in terms of making this more complicated should be heard to imply that I don't agree that there should be something. I just want us to make sure that we factor in all of the things that need to be factored into what we're talking about.
Yeah.
In Brecken, I can tell you from 30 plus years that I suspect that there are a lot more people going through pre-sentence risk assessments than you might realize and some other people might realize. And now whether or not those get turned into formal reports that have the potential to see the light of day again, that's another discussion. But mm-hmm. there are lots and lots of people. I don't know what the percentage is. Perhaps we could figure out how to try to figure that out. But there are lots of people that are going through pre-sentence evaluations, and not just people who have deep pockets that can pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, I agree with you. I mean, I will say out of our office, we do a good number of those. So I am aware that that's going on, and I am aware that there's funding for those. I think what I'm speaking to in some degree, and I do hear you saying that you're in agreement to the concept of an evaluation.
Yes.
So I didn't want to imply that. But I think what I'm speaking to is a more structured, formalized, ordered process, so to speak, versus what I think is happening now, as I understand it, is a bit more informal, and perhaps not in outlying counties, but at least in Maricopa County, it's not, it may be informally a formal part of the process, but it's not on paper anywhere. And to speak to some of the things you brought up, there's no consistency in terms of what's required in an evaluation, what kind of recommendations should it be giving, who is giving them, you know, any of those things. None of that's laid out anywhere.
Right.
You know,
Peter Morey, and I think trying to split the baby between the two of you, because I think you're both right. Something that's we agree upon is standardized. And as Brecken was just saying, something that has uniformity throughout the state as to what specifically we're looking for. To Scott's point, who it's by, who's qualified to do it, and sort of a standardized test that I agree with Brecken should be given more than once at least at maybe pre-sentence, maybe you know, certainly before treatment, but also 5 years, 10 years down the road, so we know where the person is if we're talking about getting termination of their registration and mm-hmm. notification. So right now, from my understanding, we don't have anything to track people over time, and I think that's something that we desperately need, and I think we need to put that out right at the beginning as well,
mm-hmm.
that this is a time expected time limited thing
mm-hmm.
for some people.
Mm-hmm. Probation uses the MSI. Okay. So we give an MSI initially, sort of like a pre-treatment MSI to get a baseline, and then we usually give an end of treatment MSI. But it's not a full evaluation. Right. That's the point. And that's you know, that's the piece of it. And that doesn't take into consideration, you know, the MSI is at a seventh grade, I think, reading level. And there are a lot of people who cannot take that. I mean, that's, you know, what is the average reading level? Is like second grade or something. I mean, that's really advanced wording. And so,
Peter Morey, again, to your point, it's a pretty broad test. You know, is it necessarily capturing our concerns of the individual
mm-hmm.
after treatment?
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, it's not a risk assessment.
Right.
You know, it's a really good measure of treatment progress, but in and of itself, it's not a risk assessment. Right. So it depends on the information you want to get out of it, you know, what we're looking for.
Which is, again, what I think we need to define at the beginning when we're going in. So to both your points.
Yeah.
And if I might humbly add, the MSI is a better fit for some offenders than it is for others.
Mm-hmm.
While it's true, that's the standard that we've been using. It definitely fits some cases, I think, in terms of its theoretical background, much better than it does some other cases. You know, the other instrument out there, and I know that some people in Maricopa County are using it at this point, and when I had some free time, I was going to start using it myself from an assessment standpoint, is the MDSA. And I think that it might be worth, you know, examining what the MDSA could tell us in terms of a pre, intermittent, and post-test kind of scenario, and what that might bring to our process as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think, you know, we consider all the options, and that's part of what this board and, you know, this subcommittee is for. I think what I'm trying to do by keeping our questions and our tasks small at first is to just like take it one step at a time, because I think we're going to get, I just don't want us to get lost in the topic of which tests and what, who does it. And now are we certifying providers and who, you know, what happens, because those are huge, potentially huge issues. And we're going to have to get to them. But first, in my mind, I guess first is, it sounds like everybody is in agreement that we like the idea of implementing an evaluation for adults. So then I think the next question is, when do we do that? Does it happen at the pre-sentence stage? Does it happen, you know, post-conviction and on probation, or some other time that we haven't thought of yet or heard of?
Peter Morey, very naive question. Is post-conviction always going to have probation?
No, and that is the... So yeah. I think in a pre-sentence investigation scenario, more individuals will be evaluated,
right?
Because they won't all have a probation tail.
But is there a, can we make it post-conviction and take probation and pre-sentence out of that? Meaning if you get the mm-hmm. conviction, you have the evaluation. Because what I'm thinking here, putting on my lawyer hat,
mm-hmm.
is you're going to get a lot of pushback probably from defense attorneys on the risk assessments pre-sentence.
I agree.
Not everybody's going to probation, so that would disqualify a certain population. But if it's tagged onto the conviction, then we kind of have a division there of knowing what the risk of each individual is. Not sure where I'm going with that thought completely, because mm-hmm. I'm not sure how we would mandate them to do treatment or not, but mm-hmm. at least we would know for registration and notification going forward.
Mm-hmm.
What? So Beth Golden, if I can chime in, I feel like if there's not some sort of standard for pre-sentence evaluations being done, you're still, the what has happened over the years in Arizona is it seems to be we have not separated, you committed a sex crime, what should your consequence be, versus I'm going to use a psychosexual to get myself out of trouble, and the prosecutor, okay, just take a polygraph if you had any hands-on victims. I kind of want to address those problems that we're having. So psychosexuals or any evaluations pre-sentence is not used as a potential way to manipulate the prosecutors, the court, to have someone come to probation and say, look, I passed a polygraph, but we know the polygraph is not valid because the right questions weren't asked or the right examiner wasn't used. So I feel like there need, not that, I think we need to address what if someone wants or what should happen at a pre-sentence level, because there's too much manipulation of and too much disparities going on in different cases at the pre-sentence level. And that's my opinion on that. I have concerns about how it's currently being used. Mm-hmm. And
I agree with you, Beth. I know when I was working with sex offenders, I would get very frustrated that the lawyers had so much control over these evaluations to the point they wouldn't even give them to their clients. And if an evaluation was done, as I think you said, Scott, they don't like the outcomes of that, that's not handed over to the courts. And as our first goal is supposed to be public safety, that should not be allowed. And I support all pre-sentence evaluations being mandated. I really don't care if the defense attorneys are concerned about that.
Peter Morey, I don't disagree with you, but yeah, good luck with that. So that's, from a practical purpose, that's just not going to happen.
I understand that, Beth Golden, but I understand that, but you also have people that are before the court for sex crimes, but they're then asking for, I want computer permissions, I want contact with minors. So you cannot have it both ways, because in order for the court, a prosecutor, probation, treatment, how we all should be making those decisions, we need all the information. So I get they have a right. They bypass probation assessments often, but then they go to court and they ask for a whole bunch of information that could potentially put additional victims at risk. So my concern is you can't have it both ways.
I still think we're having a discussion about what the definition of pre-sentence is. I'm not a lawyer, Peter. I'll let Peter chime in on those things. But if we're talking about making decisions that involve interactions with the community, especially children, then my sense is that we can pretty succinctly come up with a protocol here that structures what that needs to look like once somebody's been sentenced, and probably get buy-in from, if not all parties involved, pretty much all parties involved. But when you start having a discussion about it being pre-sentence, literally pre-sentence, with potential implications flowing from that, I don't want to play lawyer. I'll let Peter chime in. I think that's a bite that's going to be a very difficult one to chew and swallow at some point.
Yeah, Peter Morey, I agree with you, Scott, and that's why I was asking that question to Brecken. Is there something that is, you know, not pre-sentence, but also not pre-probation, but tied to their conviction, you know, post-sentencing? So kind of in that gray area that you're trying to identify there, Scott, I'm struggling to identify it as well.
I think we're having a discussion about after the person knows what their consequences are for their conduct, because then they've been sentenced, a legal decision has been made, they've either been sent to prison or they've been placed on probation or they've been sent to prison with a tail of probation. At that juncture, their legal rights have been addressed in terms of the sentencing process. And then if we want to structure things in a way that's meaningful for everybody, which is what I hear Beth, I think, accurately arguing for, then I think we're really having a discussion of it coming, you know, after the person's been formally sentenced.
I know Amanda has her heads up, but really quick, Beth Golden, we need to address the pre-sentence issue, because what's going to happen or continue to happen is, I want contact with my children. I want to continue at my job. I want, which is fine. You asked for that, but the court and probation at the pre-sentence level needs accurate information if a judge is going to make those recommendations. I don't think we should ignore the fact that those requests are going to go away. And the question will be, what are the recommendations of the board with regard to, and I know other states have this laid out, because I want to get away from using a psychosexual evaluation to either get what they want, or because at sentence, but it's not, then you come to probation, it doesn't do them any favors if the assessments are bad, the evaluations are bad, and they have to be redone. And then you're like, no, wait a minute, you should not have been approved to have contact with your children, or you should, and there's a lot of stuff that then has to be undone when someone comes to probation, when they were given a lot of misinformation to the court and to everybody. So that's my position on that. And Amanda, I think you have your hands up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead, Amanda.
excuse me. For me, we have to look at the purpose of the assessment. Are we doing it to assess whether they should, if they're guilty or not? Are we doing it to assess like their risk levels? Are we doing it? You know, the MSI kind of gives us a baseline and then later a follow-up. And I just want to mention that the last time we went over some of the states, we kind of laughed at one of the states that had post-sentencing pre-sentence reports completed or biopsychosocials after. So yeah. I thought I'd throw back that back out there.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. I think doing it at a pre-sentence stage has different implications for the use of the information than doing it post. I think one of the benefits of doing it post is that there's the statute that protects sort of the statements that are made. Do you need to say something? No, okay. In the context of mandated treatment. So that potentially helps the honesty. But a lot of states do it at that pre-sentence stage. But then I think in those instances, the judges then rely heavily on it for sentencing, which is what you're saying should happen, right?
There's a lot of questions sometimes that, or permissions that they're trying to get, before their, sentencing. And so how are we going to address that? I'm not saying I have the answers to those, but it doesn't necessarily mean, does someone have to do a sex history prior to, is that part of the evaluation? I would say probably not, right? Not a pre-sentence.
But it would be post.
Correct.
I think if we take out, if we look at what's currently being done and we sort of drop in a more full evaluation instead of the current ABLE MSI intake process, that is probably logistically the easiest because it's the most similar to what we're doing. Whether or not that addresses all of the issues that we're trying to address, I don't know for sure. Somebody have their hand up? Okay, Sheridan.
Hi, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Sorry, I have two different things I need to unmute. I back to the pre-sentence, I think it would also assist in balancing the severity of some sentences or make recommendations for post-sentence treatment in that, offenders with low risk are sometimes made examples of and are given harsher sentences than maybe we think are necessary because of the nature of their crime. And their risk level is low, but they are given these lengthy sentences and lengthy probation terms. I think a pre-sentence evaluation would give the opportunity to comment on that low risk for those offenders.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think my question is, if we do it, and maybe this is where we then shift into, some distribution of work and circle back to this at our next meeting. If we're thinking about doing it pre-sentence, I would be curious because, for example, that's what Colorado does. So then what do they do for someone who's then incarcerated for a long period of time? Do you have any idea? Like, do they just update?
I think there's guidelines for who. So if someone's going to prison for 300 years, I think there's we can skip A and you go to, there's guidelines for
who gets one. So that's the other question is, when are the evaluations done, but who is eligible or who is required to do one of the evaluations? is a whole nother question. I don't know that we have to have the answer for that. Maybe we do as a board, probably, but that gets into, you know, I think, right, legal, you know, depending on the statute corresponding to their charges. I don't know. Yes, Jim.
Jim Hanratty, in Idaho, they actually aren't allowed to be in treatment and probation at the pre-sentence stage. They're required to do the evaluation. There's four dedicated individuals in the whole state that are allowed to do it because they went through their SOMB requirements and guidelines. They got the seal of approval, and the offenders have to actually travel to those individuals. They're mandated to do that, even if it's all the way from the panhandle all the way down. They got to go and do the assessment. And that is actually mandatory for adults that are convicted of sex crimes based on their statutes.
Post-conviction they do it, or this is part of their pre-sentence?
This is part of their pre-sentence where they're assigned to do so. And they're not even eligible for that probation until they do it. Sorry, there's a rope flying down. Right? It's happening.
Did you start to say something, Scott, or was that someone else?
I was simply going to ask the same question you did. It sounds like although Jim said post-conviction, I think what he was talking about was pre-sentence.
Yes. Did I say yes?
Pre-sentence.
Yeah. You do it in the pre-sentence stage. And that makes them eligible to be in post-conviction, in the post-conviction guidelines once they are done. Now, assuming that they're going to go to prison or not go to prison, that starts when they get out.
Yeah, I'm just kind of sitting and chewing on stuff that's being articulated, and I apologize for perhaps making this more complicated than it is. But at the same time, I think we're wise to take the time to do it, because then we will have thought through a bunch of things that we're later going to get pushback on. If we had taken the time now, we won't. I'm struggling a little bit, not with the concept of doing a pre-sentence risk assessment and doing it in a uniformed way. I'm just trying to get my brain around what that consists of and how that actually gives us the information we need to be able to answer some really important questions about risk. I mean, I think we're going to have a hard time trying to include a polygraph with that. I'm not saying I heard anybody say they're arguing for that. Yet at the same time, in the absence of polygraph information, I think your capacity to make a true decision about somebody's risk is diminished. So, like, outside of the ABLE, which is going to, if it's a valid ABLE, is going to tell us something about somebody's sexual interests. I mean, are we really talking about making a decision based on an MSI and an ABLE here? I'm struggling. Just somebody help me, please.
Well, hey, Scott, sorry, Peter Morey. I'm kind of with you there, Scott. I'm not meaning to make things more complicated. I'm kind of admittedly over here in my little world spinning through possibilities. But I think Missy brought it up, and I agree with her. And my comment was a little bit flip, but you can't trust lawyers, which is where my comment was coming from. So I'm wondering, is this something that we can mandate as a judicial package pre-sentence? So if we mandate a pre-sentence judicial package where an evaluation is assigned by the court, similar to what Mr. Hanratty was saying about, you know, we have special evaluators who are trained along with the Sex Offender Management Board guidelines. Yeah. And what Brecken was talking about. And we include a polygraph in that, and that's kind of kept in camera and maybe released simultaneously to the teams pre-sentence, then we wouldn't necessarily have all the gamesmanship, time, or ability from the attorneys, and the judge would get the information on risk and treatment at the time of sentencing so that he could go forward from there, and that would give all the treatment providers and probation the information they need to go forward to try to take some of the kinks out of the system.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just a brainstorming idea.
And Missy Music, I mean, we still have those more static evaluations to add into the pre-sentence evaluations. It's not like it would be just an MSI and a unable.
If we have good history, Missy, if we have good information about their history, especially their sexual history, we do. I mean, the scores somebody gets on a static 99 or a static 2002R or a SOREG are only as good as the information that's brought to the equation. I mean, if we don't have complete information, everybody's going to be being scored lower than they probably actually are.
You're right.
Yeah. And to Scott's point, that was part of my Peter Mooring, sorry. That was part of my concern of the pre-sentence evaluation too, is that you're going to have your defense attorneys advising their clients to minimize, and you're going to have prosecutors maximizing. So that's why I'm suggesting we have something that's from an SOMB approved, assigned by the judge, reviewed in camera with the results simultaneously distributed to defense and prosecution.
Jim Hanratty, just give you some insight as to Florida, for example. Florida does it a little differently. I know that Florida wasn't on our checklist to do, but Florida actually waits until after the sentencing, so there's not the pre-conviction concerns legally and all the other loopholes that are there, or concerns that are there, legitimate and otherwise. But once the person is assigned to a treatment provider, whether it's in the prison system or in community supervision, the treatment provider, who is approved by their board, then felicitates the evaluation, chooses their individuals that are going to subcontract out for, say, example, polygraph. And once those folks are approved, the treatment folks that are approved to do the actual treatment and assessment, they kind of facilitate that whole process for the future of that individual while they're in community supervision or in a treatment facility or treatment program in prison, which incidentally is a little bit different than Idaho, because the evaluators that do the risk assessment that are approved in Idaho do not do treatment. And the people that do the treatment, ongoing treatment, don't do the evaluations. I'm not sure why they did it that way, but maybe there was a conflict of interest or the, you know, the optics of it or whatever it was, and they decided not to do that. So a lot of states do it a little differently, but I think we've come to a consensus here that we have to do it one way or the other, whether we do it pre-conviction mandated by the courts to make them eligible for probation and treatment, or whether a treatment provider does it. Right now, probation's kind of slinging it. So, you know, when a person is on community supervision, a probation officer or probation division will make a call on whether or not they're going to accept whatever information they're getting from whoever's giving it, from a treatment perspective or polygraph perspective, as to whether or not these individuals are getting certain privileges or getting certain conditions placed on them that are kind of, well, willy-nilly, if you don't mind me saying. There's no real standardization, and it's kind of a crapshoot. I don't think that's right any way you slice it, but I think we've all agreed that there's got to be some guidelines that we're all going to adhere to. We need to cross the bridge as to whether or not it's going to be an adjudication as part of that package, that judicial package that you referred to. I think that's a good way to put it. Or are we going to wait till after they're sentenced and let, you know, probation continue to do that and guideline probation standards to do that, or a treatment provider? So we're still talking about, you know, I think we're still in the stage of pre-conviction.
Yeah, I, Peter Moore, I agree with you, Jim. My only pushback on everything you just said is that not everybody goes to probation.
Right.
And I think that we still need that risk information, even if they're not going to probation. So
what would be the,
what would you want it for? I guess, what would you want the risk information for? Well, say they're
not going to probation, they may still have to register, correct?
So for registration.
Right. So we need to keep it in mind for registration. Where are they going to be placed on registration? What are the risks?
I know, except that, and then now we get into the thing we heard about last week at the meeting, right? The registry, like, that's supposed to be
right, and that's
the assessment used for whether or not someone, or for the registration notification levels. And so you're talking about using the psychosexual to determine whether or not they even need to register at all.
Yeah, partly do they need to register at all? What level of registration? And, you know, we have to tackle, and I'm getting far ahead of us here, but we're going to have to tackle that eventually anywhere, is registration and notification and all that. So kind of a preview to that is, if we have all this information up front and they're going to have to register and say they don't have probation, this risk assessment is going to help, you know, what level of registration do they even need to register? You know, and one of the things that we kind of talked about today with the lunch and presentation and all that is, okay, that's an interesting thing for identifying people who may not have to register, but they have this history. So would we even have to publicly notify if we had something that could identify somebody being in the wrong place? You know, that's a little Big Brother-ish, but it also has interesting implications for not having to put somebody's public information out there if they're already such a low offender, and not make a victim out of the offender. And it would also be a force multiplier for the resources we already have.
But registration isn't a treatment issue, really.
But you can't separate the two.
I think you can.
How?
Well, there's lots to be said about registration, in the whole phenomena of registration, but I think, you know, the more I participate in this discussion today, and the more I listen to other people from their vantage points talk, I can respect the hell out of the fact that I want to get something going here for sure, but I'm also mindful of the fact that unless we think about this in some sort of integrated way, we're going to be asking for more trouble than we probably want.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, are we still talking about the pre-conviction protocol that we agreed upon 3 months ago, that we're going to tackle that first? We're going to tackle that section first.
And right? Jim, yes, yes, we are. And I, as I tried to state in there, that I probably didn't put very well, I'm getting way ahead of where we need to go. Right. So yes, we need to reel it back in. I was getting into the weeds, but yes, okay, we're still talking about that.
Yeah, and I think pre-conviction in the sense that it doesn't, our recommendation for Arizona doesn't have to be pre-conviction, but just that we're looking at what happens sort of across the board at that stage. But if we don't think, which it may be the way that I'm understanding the discussion to be going, is that we're not leaning necessarily towards a pre-sentence risk assessment evaluation. It seems like that's where maybe the consensus is, but I think this is, you know, to your point, Scott, can be it is a big discussion. It's a larger discussion. There's a lot of ramifications for it in terms of people's, you know, the legal rights, the logistics, the sentencing, who pays for it. I mean, there's all kinds of different pieces of this. And so I think shifting a little bit into the next agenda item in terms of distribution of work, I think we will be able to discuss it to some extent in here, but some of it will probably be us, again, kind of looking at what comes next in other areas, or what do we think is best in bringing back information to continue this discussion about it, you know, informed. I mean, I'm curious, I guess, if in the states that do, did I say this maybe, but in the states like Colorado or the other ones, like I think it's Utah, that do the evaluation at a pre-sentence stage, you know, then what happens, right? I mean, what I know that in their guidelines, they have what constitutes an evaluation and what those different pieces of it, but I would need to look back more closely to see kind of the process of it. What happens? Do they recalculate risk? Do they do a portion of it again, all of it again? How do they go forward with it from there?
Look at those individual states.
Yeah, I think we should.
And
that's a great idea.
Go ahead, Missy. Yeah.
And I haven't looked at those Colorado, oh my gosh, probably 15 years, but it was very structured. Like they broke everything down on times and who did what. It was extremely structured.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure the information exists, you know, for us. So I think we took the first piece of it and we looked at what are people doing kind of at these early stages. Okay, so a lot of states are doing an evaluation, either pre-sentence investigation, maybe post-conviction, depending on their, you know, jurisdiction. So I think our task is then to say, okay, with that information, we like the idea of evaluation. How does that fit here in Arizona and suit our needs? So, but we maybe need to look at what is, you know, the next step for other states. So I think the states that are doing that are Colorado, Idaho, and Utah of the ones we looked at. Is that accurate? Did I miss any?
I can research others and see if there's are others.
Do you want to see? Okay.
If you want.
Yeah, that would be great. So you'll take the whole rest of the U.S. is Jim.
I just happen to have the Idaho ones handy all, you know.
So you'll do Idaho.
Some pages of it. So, I mean, I'll be happy to do Idaho to clarify that for sure.
Okay.
But I'll cursory check.
Just take a look. I know. I was, you know, thinking about the rest of the U.S. Okay.
I'm not going to Hawaii, though. Not for that.
Okay. Does anyone, so the other states that we had already looked at were Colorado and Utah. Does anyone want to volunteer to take a look at kind of how they translate the evaluation into practice? What do they take from it? Kind of the next steps.
This is Sheridan. I'm happy to continue with Utah.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Does anyone want to take Colorado? If not, I can do it.
I very hesitantly, just because of time, but I can see if I can get an updated thing of Colorado, because I still have the old one.
You can easily get it, Missy. It's online. Be prepared for the fact that it's in excess of probably 400 pages. But it's there and it's downloadable and it's printable. So it's there.
Yeah, I know I have the old one and it was probably close to 400. So yeah, I can just review that first section.
They do have a good kind of their table of contents and how they lay everything out. You know, it should be, like you were saying, it's very structured. It's very matter of fact in terms of how they do it. So, okay. Okay, that's great. Thank you. Well, Missy, I'm happy to help with that also. So if you get to a point where you're stuck or you don't have time, you know, let me know. We can work on it together. Is there anywhere else that anyone wants to look at in terms of information within that regard, kind of for
Florida might be interesting just because they do it.
Their treatment providers do it.
They do it.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's potential conflicts there, so I'd be curious how they avoid that.
Okay. So this is Amanda Adkins. I previously did Illinois. I can follow up on that one, or if people have other recommendations that are more appealing, I'm open to researching. I'm also curious what ATSA would say about it.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. Well, would you be willing to get us some information at least on ATSA? Because Illinois didn't do an evaluation. Is that right?
To be honest, I don't remember. My apologies.
No, that's okay. I think that they didn't. But ATSA would be great. Yeah. And then we can kind of continue this discussion.
And to clarify what they are using the risk, not risk assessments, but the assessments for, how that translates into practice. Just so I'm clear.
Yeah, I think so. Or if other people have, you know, opinions on what they think would be helpful in terms of the next stage of information, I think where I see our discussion having landed today is that we all agree that the concept of an evaluation early on in the process is important for Arizona. It could be helpful, but we haven't landed on what timeline that may be. If it's pre-sentence, if it's post-conviction, and then, so I think we're maybe looking at other states, and if they do it pre-sentence, how does that translate into, you know, the folks that are on probation, and kind of what do people do sort of practically, I guess, with the evaluations next? I think that's how I'm seeing it, but again, I'm open to, you know, feedback if other people see the discussion having gone a different way.
I think the only thing that I would add, Brecken, is perhaps, and I'm open to doing this with you, Brecken, and anybody else. Like, what do we think that should include? What is the baseline set of testing that we think will give us the most meaningful information to make some of these decisions and to inform the court about, you know, things that people are asking for permissions for and so on and so forth. I'm trying to wrap my head around it as I sit here with it, and perhaps some more dialogue around that, you know, outside of the actual committee meeting will flesh some of that out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that's going to be a huge piece of this. I think most helpful will be that there's potentially you know, standards for what's recommended, the test, you know, I think that structured is going to be helpful so that there's consistency. I know only because I looked at Colorado's, I know that they have outlined very specifically what they want. I would imagine other states that do the evaluations also have similar standards for what's included and, you know, what they deem to be an acceptable, reliable test versus what's not and all those things. Yeah, I think that's a really going to be a crucial part of this. Absolutely. So.
This is Sheridan. I have a, maybe it's a legal question, but are there not, is there not such a thing as a post-conviction but pre-sentence period for, you know, for a pre-sentence evaluation that would avoid that legal realm?
I'm sorry, say that, say that one more time, Sheridan. I'm sorry.
Post-conviction but pre-sentence.
There is a post-conviction pre-sentence period. But there's a lot of gamesmanship that goes into that time, which is what we're talking about. And I made the flip comment earlier about not trusting lawyers because there's a lot of evaluations that go on there that never see the light of day or something like that. And that's kind of the period that I was alluding to when I was talking about having a judge's packet that instead of having the room, that wiggle room in there for, you know, sort of a mitigation phase versus aggravation phase that each attorney side is playing, to have something that the judge mandates they do uniformly, and then that evaluation is what they judge their sentencing on. So a judicially mandated, here's what I need for a risk and evaluation information to make my decision. And then that would be published afterwards to evaluators, probation, registration, notification, that kind of thing. So easy answer is yes, with caveats, which is totally unhelpful. But
clear as mud.
Clear as mud, exactly.
Okay, we only have 9 minutes left. We have to have a hard stop time at 3 o'clock today. So stop there in terms of the distribution of work to be completed outside. And then there's always room, I think, to email agenda items and different things if needed. The last agenda items, I believe, discussion of guiding principles, discussion prioritization of duties and responsibilities, discussion of the current community notification assessment. I think those are things that need to be kind of on our radar. I think we'll be asked to take a look at the guiding principles in kind of as a subcommittee in a smaller group and make sure we're kind of aligned in terms of how those should look going forward, and potentially making recommendations or presenting our position on that to the larger board. And I believe Major Mitchell sent those out. Again, right? So
yes, Jenna Mitchell, yes, those have been sent out, and we can do it however you want. If board members or subcommittee members want to send in their thoughts, revisions, suggestions, we can compile those and then the committee can discuss them, or if you want to just take some time, review them, and then have the discussion at the next meeting, that's an option as well.
Okay. I'll put it on the agenda, I think, for next time, but I think if folks are able to take a look at it outside, that would save us time from having to sort of read it word for word together. But I do think we can discuss it. Someone have their hand up.
Yeah. So those guiding principles, are those Colorado's guiding principles?
Yes.
The ones that we started with. Yeah. I think what was proposed initially were Colorado's is what we started with.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just wanted to verify that. I thought they probably were, they looked like what I had read in the Colorado standards, but mm-hmm. I didn't know the point of reference.
Yes, I think it's Colorado, but I admittedly haven't done a deep dive into the guiding principles of other state boards, and I'm sure that they exist. And so I think the point here is that what works for Colorado doesn't necessarily work for us, but it's at least a starting point, you know, and we can kind of go from there. The discussion and prioritization of duties and responsibilities, I don't know for sure what I need to be discussing about that one.
To put that on there, okay. Instead of doing it with a larger board, she felt that if the subcommittees could give advice and guidelines to the larger board,
then we should go first. Well, okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, we've kind of taken our taken the statute and started to look at things kind of chronologically and in the order that the statute tells us to do. But I do know, and this probably goes into the last agenda item discussion of the current community notification assessment. I think, as we're all aware, a more hot button issue is notification and registration. So I don't know, to be honest with you, exactly how to integrate that into what we're doing or if we want to tackle that in some way.
Right there.
I know that's what I mean. Like that's a little.
It's massive.
But I do think, yeah, it's massive. And so.
Well, if I may, Brecken, this is Peter, I think my comment earlier to Jim about, it's something we have to consider is because regardless of the risk notification, or I'm sorry, risk assessments, treatment advice or treatment recommendations we have to keep those in mind because it's going to affect how people do treatment, how they're perceived, the stigma that goes with them, and all of that. So, and that's simply what I mean by it's not black and white, Jim, is that it's going to realistically impact people and realistically impact victims, whichever way we go. So it's necessarily going to have to be in the background with everything we decide. Where we tackle it and how we tackle it, I'm not sure yet.
I think you're really actually right on, and I think we should get the input of every victim before they get off registration. I think we got to incorporate that in the guidelines somehow so they have their say, because they're like the silent victim in all this. Mm-hmm. Their registration as a victim doesn't end anytime in their lifetime.
True. Yeah.
So, maybe we should be contacting the victims and requiring that victims have their say and their input.
They actually do have that, and that's built into the existing system, especially when changes in status from probation to non-probation take place. There's a mechanism in the judicial process.
It's for probation release, not registration release.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think even though they are intertwined,
we
would probably have to, in some ways, table or pause our discussion about evaluations and then change our efforts into the community notification, just because they both require so much research and focus and so much time. We don't have hours and hours to be here all together. So I would say for now, let's continue on with our evaluation piece, and then I can do a little more research and, work with Major Mitchell in terms of if there's some kind of sort of a need for us to shift in a way to put something else first, find that out and let the committee know. Otherwise, let's kind of carry on.
Agreeing with you, just let's get to a place where we're comfortable with this, then we can shift focus and then figure out how to put them together.
Yeah. And when to shift do we need to stop this right now and like move or, but so for now, let's just carry on. Okay. All right. I am going to move to adjourn the meeting. Would someone like to second the motion?
It's Peter Morey, second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Okay. The motion carries. The meeting is over. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for your patience with our technical difficulties.
and the timing. Thank you. Thank you all.
Does it get off tomorrow?